sanctions on Russia, fond memories of Bear Stearns, and steel is back, baby. Well, maybe. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, 15 March. Today, good as always to have you along, everybody. Big day for Russia and the Trump White House today. 6 months and a couple of days ago, you might remember, Congress passed and the president signed something called the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act, CATSA for short, part of which called for sanctions on Russian organizations or individuals over interference with the 2016 elections in this country. Today, the Treasury Department imposed those sanctions on 19 people and 5 Russian companies, and also the United States joined Britain, Germany, and France in blaming Russia for a nerve gas attack in the UK that left a former Russian double agent and his daughter in critical condition in a British hospital. As Marketplace's Stephen Beard starts us off from London, the British government has expelled 23 Russian diplomats and launched a package of retaliatory financial measures.
With permission, Mr. Speaker, I would like to make a statement.
In Britain's Parliament, Prime Minister Theresa May blamed the Kremlin directly for what she called the brazen and reckless use of an illegal Russian-made chemical weapon on British soil. Among her retaliatory measures, a curb on the flow of people and goods coming into Britain from Russia.
We will increase checks on private flights, customs and freight. We will freeze Russian state assets wherever we have the evidence that they may be used to threaten the life or property of UK nationals or residents.
May also promised a British version of the US Magnitsky Act, freezing the assets of individual Russians implicated in human rights abuses and denying them visas.
There is no place for these people or their money in our country.
A welcome but belated stand, as far as some observers are concerned. Anne Applebaum, a Pulitzer Prize-winning expert on Russia, is a long-standing critic of Britain's toleration of Putin's cronies.
Russians keep their money, their wives, their children, their property in this country and in Western Europe. Ending the money laundering that Russia does through here, enforcing our own laws, all of that could make an enormous difference.
Critics say Britain has been shameless in courting Russian cash. The London Stock Exchange recently accepted a listing from Oleg Deripaska, an oligarch close to Putin. Some of the proceeds from the share sale went to a Russian bank subject to sanctions. British intermediaries have made millions out of deals like this. Former Polish Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski thinks that such financial links may have been a factor in the decision to authorize the nerve agent attack.
I think President Putin is wagering that Britain is so hooked on Russian money in London that the response will be muted.
The British government says it's learned its lesson. It will crack down. Security Minister Ben Wallace makes a startling admission about successive British administrations.
We have allowed the City of London's reputation as a centre for world finance to be exploited by some pretty nasty individuals who have used illicit money flows to clean it or invest it.
But where should Britain draw the line? The theme song of the Chelsea soccer club owned by Roman Abramovich, another oligarch close to Putin. Russian money is embedded in Britain, and vice versa. The giant UK oil company BP has a huge stake in Russia, deriving a third of its production from there. Philip Warman is a political risk analyst.
There are UK companies in Russia, BP, that are possibly vulnerable to counter-sanctions, and we know that the Russian parliament is preparing what it calls mirror measures.
This crisis comes at a difficult time for Britain's financiers. Thanks to Brexit and the possible loss of access to the European Union, they will be eager to keep their markets wide open to the rest of the world. Shutting up shop, even to dodgy Russians, won't be popular in Britain's financial centre. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
One more Russia thing before we move on. The New York Times reported today special counsel Robert Mueller has subpoenaed the Trump Organization for records of the president's businesses, which are, it should be said here, officially being run by his sons. No idea what's in those documents, but traders were not thrilled at the news. They took the edge off their Dow rally when it broke. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The The media story of this Thursday picks up at Chapter 11 of the federal bankruptcy code. iHeartMedia, which operates more than 800 radio stations in the United States and employs more than 19,000 people worldwide, is seeking the protection of the bankruptcy courts. It is a Today story, yes, but it actually began in 2008 with iHeartMedia being bought up by private equity firms, which, as private equity firms are wont to do, loaded the company up with debt. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that one.
10 years ago, the private equity firms Bain Capital and Thomas H. Lee Partners bought iHeartMedia for nearly $24 billion. Private equity firms are investment firms that bundle money from investors to buy companies.
The idea is to improve the functioning of the company and to sell it eventually at a profit.
Eileen Applebaum at the Center for Economic and Policy Research says these purchases tend to leave companies with a lot of debt. The way they work, the buyers put up a small portion of the purchase price and borrow the rest. Then they put the debt on the company they buy.
So the debt that was used to acquire iHeartMedia became the responsibility of iHeartMedia to repay.
So in 2008, the private equity firms put nearly $14 billion of debt on iHeart. The problem is, over the past decade, the commercial radio industry has come under pressure. For one thing, companies like iHeart have lost listeners to streaming services like Spotify and Pandora. Brooke Duffy teaches at Cornell.
If iHeartRadio can't show advertisers that, hey, we are reaching X number of people, then advertisers are not going to invest in them.
And Greg Portell, a partner at A.T. Kearney, says with fewer ad dollars coming in, iHeart started having trouble making its debt payments.
When you're carrying that much debt and not growing, it's a recipe for a bankruptcy.
And that's the thing about private equity buyouts. If an industry gets into trouble, it's hard for a company to survive. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
I was in New Haven, Connecticut this week for a long talk with Ben Bernanke, Tim Geithner, and Hank Paulson about the financial crisis, their roles in it, and what they think would happen in this economy if, or really when, we have another financial crisis. We're going to air that interview on Monday, but I want to play a little bit of Hank Paulson right here as a way to set up this next story. Paulson was, you might remember, the Secretary of the Treasury during the crisis, and since the 10th anniversary of Bear Stearns is this week, at one point when we were talking, I asked him what he thought would have happened back in 2008 if Bear had been allowed to go down. Here's what he said.
I think that if we had had Bear Stearns go down, we would have had shortly thereafter, you know, Lehman go down. We would not have. Can you imagine if we had not nationalized Fannie or Freddie first, $5.4 trillion in assets, nine times bigger than Lehman, it hadn't stabilized that. So the part of the story I would add on was after the Bear rescue, Ben and I went and talked with Barney Frank at the House Financial Services Committee. And Barney's memory is the same as ours. We went up there and we said, you know, we learned something, Barney. We don't have the powers, the emergency powers in our regulatory system to dealing with a failing non-bank. And when an investment bank starts to go, it, in the middle of a run, it disintegrates very quickly if you don't have the emergency power to guarantee or to put in capital. And so we need some kind of emergency resolution authority.
Hank Paulson there, the Treasury Secretary for the last couple of years of the George W. Bush administration. Our interview with Paulson, former Fed Chair Ben Bernanke, and Tim Geithner, who was at the time the president of the New York Fed, is coming up on Monday. Our project about the crisis and the 10 years since is called Divided Decade, How the Near Collapse of the American Economy Changed Us as a Country. Amy Scott was our New York bureau chief at the time, and she got to know one couple as the crisis was playing itself out.
I first met Justin Brannan and Lee Holiday in March of 2009, a year after Bear's collapse. He had been on the support staff at Bear Stearns Asset Management.
We supported all those guys that kind of brought the house down, all the hedge funds. So, you know, the asset-backed securities, mortgage-backed securities, all that stuff.
When a new fund launched, his team would send out gifts branded with the fund's name. One day, he was delivering a box of Bear Stearns umbrellas to headquarters when he met Lee. She worked as an executive assistant in the corporate real estate division.
And oddly enough, I recognized him.
She recognized him because before he landed at Bear, Justin had played guitar in a hardcore punk band called Indecision.
It was definitely a fan. So it was very
small world.
Very small world thing.
Lee was an artist and former teacher, and they hit it off immediately.
It was cool to know someone else worked there, you know, that had no business working at Bear Stearns, basically.
Actually, Bear Stearns prided itself on being an unconventional bank. Its legendary former CEO, Ace Greenberg, was known for valuing street smarts over pedigree.
His thing is that an MBA isn't important. What's important is a PSD, poor, smart, and determined to be rich. It was a real underdog, real family type company.
But not long after they met, there were signs of trouble. In the summer of 2007, Justin's division had to liquidate two hedge funds as the subprime mortgage market collapsed.
And then I remember the day, it was a Friday in March, and we were just watching the ticker, watching the stock, and we were like, holy.
Oh, yeah, you could literally watch it fall.
It was just going and going. We were like,
so sad.
What's going on?
The rest is well known. A few days later, the Fed and the Treasury orchestrated a bailout by J.P. Morgan Chase.
Can we just get an order of onion rings?
When I met Justin and Lee a year later at a diner in Brooklyn, they were both out of work. By then, Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch were gone, too. The unemployment rate was at a 25-year high of 8.5%.
It's just scorched earth out there. And you're up against people that are way more qualified and... And it really makes you reassess everything. Maybe I have no business working in finance. Like, you know, call the boys and get the band back together. Because, like, you don't know what else to do.
Fast forward to September 2017. And Justin has reinvented himself again.
Lisa, my name is Justin Brannon. I'm running for city council. I just came by to introduce myself.
That's right. He's running as a Democrat for New York City Council to represent Bay Ridge, the neighborhood in Brooklyn where he grew up. After Bear, he eventually found his way into government, working for a city councilman. And he fell in love with public service.
Once I really fell in love with it, I think I realized that's what I was always meant to be doing.
Lee is running her own art school for kids, something she'd dreamed of while working on Wall Street. Some of the seed money came from her severance from Bear Stearns.
I would joke with my bosses all the time. Anywhere I would end up, I would say, you know, oh, no, I'm a teacher at heart. I know I'll end up with kids again someday.
Hold that. Let me give you three brushes.
What do you mean? I need three brushes.
Three brushes, three colors.
In 2012, they got married in an unusual venue, 383 Madison Avenue, the former headquarters of Bear Stearns.
We just so identified with that space as far as us meeting and falling in love and our whole story. So we just really couldn't envision any other place.
Justin Brannon came out on top in a tight contest in City Council District 43, edging out Republican John Quaglione.
In November, Justin wins the election. And a few months later, I visit him at his office in Bay Ridge. It's budget season, so he's got a stream of people coming into his office to plug their programs.
Nice, great nice meeting you.
Yeah, thanks for coming
Thank
in.
Thank you.
Right on. Good seeing you,
brother.
Cheers. Been good.
10 years after Bear, he says what happened led him here to try to make a difference in City Hall. He sponsored a bill to educate kids about the dangers of opioids and another to protect homeless youth.
Having a front row seat for the collapse and seeing how many people were affected by that just really crystallized things for me. And I think ultimately you're going to be judged by the amount of lives you've touched and the people you've helped. And for me, this is the best place to get that done.
These days, Justin favors suits. His full sleeve tattoos peek out below his perfectly pressed cuffs. One of them is a tattoo he and Lee both share of an umbrella representing the ones from Bear Stearns he delivered when they met. In Brooklyn, New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We've got pictures of Justin and Lee's Bear Stearns wedding at marketplace.org. You can hear more of their story on this week's Marketplace Weekend. Coming up,
the scorecard is sort of the opening the door to the conversation.
Sometimes in life, as in school, grades do matter. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials added 0.4% today, 115 points, 24,873 on the blue chips. NASDAQ down about 0.2%, 15 points, 74.81. S&P 500 down less than 0.1%. We'll call that flat, 27.47. Toys R Us is going away, as you've heard, and that is sending toy makers big and small in search of new stores to showcase their wares. Among the big players, Mattel down 2.3% today. Hasbro off 0.4%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.82%. You're listening to Marketplace. You go first this time.
Hey, I'm Molly Wood.
And I'm Kai Rizdahl.
Our podcast, Make Me Smart, is back, and we are exploring something you need to succeed in business, politics, you know, basically everywhere.
It is the art, the lost art, some might say, of compromise.
Yeah, because this country is not going to get where it needs to go. Frankly, you and your boss are not going to get where you need to go if you cannot even get people in the room.
We're not doing the room.
The
where
room
it
where it happens.
We're not.
How come we can't? Can we just compromise on this one issue?
No.
Just sing like a little bit?
No. Check us out at makemesmart.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The pro-tariff economic narrative. We are talking here, of course, about the Trump steel and aluminum tariffs that go into effect on the 23rd of March. That narrative is that long-abandoned steel mills are going to come back to life. The mills operating at less than capacity are going to pump up production, and American jobs lost to foreign competition are going to come back. That is the narrative. Economic reality might have a different take. From WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris takes a look at what it would take to bring steel back.
When Ed Schutte was 19, he walked into a steel mill and walked out with a job. It was 1978, and steel was still a sure thing here. But within a few years, he and thousands of other workers in southwestern Pennsylvania were scrambling for work. Schutte moved through jobs, factories, retail, tending bar, because steel...
I didn't think any of it was going to open back up.
Then in 2004, steel came calling, and Schutte took a job at U.S. Steel's Egger Thompson Works. Just looking at it takes you back a couple centuries. Built in the late 1800s and still belching smoke from its hulking structure, it's the last of its kind around here. But where the mill once employed thousands of workers, today it employs 600. Schutte, who I meet at the union hall across the street, says with the new tariffs...
Now finally somebody's stepping up to the plate and doing what needs to be done, putting us back on a level playing field with the rest of the world.
But somebody did step up before. In 2002, President Bush enacted similar tariffs. By the end of the next year, they were gone. James Kraft, a business professor at the University of Pittsburgh.
Because of the complaints of other manufacturers in terms of the cost of steel had gone up for them and so forth and so on.
Under the new tariffs, more people lost their jobs in industries that use steel than worked in the steel industry altogether. Kraft says one reason tariffs didn't do much, by then the industry was in no shape to compete. It hadn't kept up with years of technological change.
We didn't update ourselves in the sense of, you know, really responding to the kind of technology and the kind of opportunities we had for enhancing our competitive position. We kind of stagnated.
And now, those mills that are still standing are even further behind. Jim Johnston is a third-generation steelworker. Standing outside the giant Egger Thompson mill as trucks lug slag to dump sites, Johnston says to boost production at this mill, updates would have to be made.
We're hoping that U.S. Steel is going to spend more with capital improvements here in the facility, which would help create jobs and make us more relevant for the future.
Johnston is also the local union president, and he was standing behind President Trump in the Oval Office when he signed off on tariffs last week. Even with improvements, Johnston says the mill could never employ thousands of workers again.
Obviously, with modernization, you lose jobs. It doesn't take as many people to do the work.
And lots of other things have changed, too, like environmental regulations, the way we move raw materials around the world, the labor force. Josh Spores, a steel analyst with Crew Group, says mini mills are where the future is headed and where the profit is. Tricking out one of these old mills would take years and...
maybe $20 million or so to bring it back up and get it running again.
And that's not happening.
Those mills are gone. They'll never come back. You would need to have an environment here that requires a new mill to be built from the ground up.
The more likely future of steel in Pittsburgh is on display where I meet historian Ron Barriff at the Cary Furnace. Before shutting down years ago, the furnace produced tons of iron that was shipped across the Monongahela River to a thriving steel mill. At one time, more than 15,000 workers clocked in every day.
You know, we often joke about having that magic switch that you can throw to turn these blast furnaces back on, but you can't. That time is gone.
Today, the furnace is a museum. The mill, a shopping complex with dozens of stores and restaurants that bring in $450 million a year. Barriff, who specializes in steel history, leads tours of the furnace. People whose relatives worked in the mills, tourists, newcomers to Pittsburgh who want to know its past.
There's a beauty in this rust. And there's a beauty in this change over time.
A change that tariffs and technology aren't likely to reverse. In Pittsburgh, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
It took an extra day or so, but Democrat Colin Lamb squeaked out a win in that special election in Pennsylvania this week, just beat Republican Rick Saccone. Not technically on the ballot, but very much a factor, the National Rifle Association. The NRA endorsed Saccone, giving him a 100% rating on its candidate scorecard. Lots of groups, interest groups, score politicians, of course. Candidates then run on those grades, or sometimes run from them, because either way, they are powerful. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains why.
Politicians love to brag about their political scores or have others do it for them. Here's an ad for Luther Strange during the special election to replace Alabama Republican Jeff Sessions in the Senate.
Two candidates for Senate. Most Republicans like them both, but only one is 100% for our gun rights. Big Luther Strange.
In the end, that top score didn't do much for Strange. He lost the primary to Roy Moore. But Republican Congressman Dave Brad of Virginia says his 100% rating from the National Federation of Independent Business helped push him over the finish line, and he's eager to boast about that good grade.
Yeah, that one I cite more often than any other, just because it's so huge.
Brad says scorecards make for good shorthand, a way to sum up his record.
So I've used them in the past to say, hey, I promised to vote this way, and I got 100% down the line with a bunch of groups.
But bunch doesn't begin to describe the scorecard universe. There are around 700 different groups scoring state and national politicians on tons of issues. Groups like Planned Parenthood, the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, and the Humane Society. Walker McCusick is national director of the group Vote Smart, which tracks all this scorekeeping. He says a lot of these groups have
very, very specific interests that you wouldn't think would be able to come up with actions in a legislature to rate legislators on, but they are able to find them.
Like the American Library Association, which grades candidates on their support for education funding bills, like
the Strengthening Kids' Interest in Learning and Libraries Act, or Skills Act.
There's also Plug in America. It wants tax credits for consumers who buy electric vehicles.
Where there's a will, there's a score.
And McCusick says voters pay attention to this stuff. He says more than 10 million people went to the VoteSmart site in 2016. Now, many of these groups grade politicians after a vote. But some prefer to use scorecards for arm twisting. Take the Conservative Heritage Foundation's lobbying arm, Heritage Action. Dan Holler is the group's vice president.
The scorecard is sort of the opening the door to the conversation.
And without knocking first, Heritage Action lobbyists buttonhole lawmakers and let them know up front they're scoring an issue. And here's the way to a good grade.
You should jump on board to this bill and be one of the leaders of this effort.
Members of Congress who aren't in the mood to lead, they're given a bad score before they even vote. Not that that's a game changer. Again, Virginia Congressman Dave Brat.
A scorecard has never influenced my vote to hit some score on a scorecard.
But when he hits it, there it is on his website, next to a donate here button. Politicians don't typically highlight their scores in TV ads. They're trying to reach a broader audience, and their stand on, say, the Small Business Regulatory Flexibility Improvements Act might not be all that useful.
the ratings might be used more often in an attack stance on TV.
Says Erica Franklin Fowler, co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project. So you can nail your opponent for not supporting tax cuts or being in favor of increasing immigration. But the groups behind the scorecards aren't just looking to sway voters. Franklin Fowler says they want to burnish their own reputations, too.
I think it's more attention. I think it's calling them out as being important in a particular policy debate, that the candidates think that they're important enough to be mentioned.
And important equals influence, the most valuable currency in Washington. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a quick trade tutorial for members of the White House staff and its occupant. The Washington Post reported today on an audio tape of a fundraiser President Trump held last night in which the president said he was making it up in a meeting with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau when he said the United States has a trade deficit with Canada. "I didn't even know. I had no idea," is the direct quote. Press Secretary Sarah Sanders was, of course, asked about this at the White House briefing today. Her tweeted reply after she left the podium was to point out the trade deficit the U.S. has with Canada in goods, that is, stuff, which is true. We buy more actual stuff from Canada than we send there. Thing is, here in the global economy, trade is done in goods and services. And according to the U.S. Trade Representative of the Trump administration, our goods and services trade surplus with Canada was $12.5 billion in 2016. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials is up 0.4% today. NASDAQ was off about 0.2%. S&P 500 basically flat. John Buckley, Drew Dedepke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.